Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Because I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would bias.
As a journalist and a congressman.
It's Wednesday, January 25th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. We come to you each week from the Missouri School of Journalism with a fresh take on issues involving the news media. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Joining the discussion this week are regular panelists Charles Davis and, sitting in for Lee Wilkins, Linda Kraxberger. Linda runs the Convergence Journalism Program here at Mizzou. On today's program, how did the media frame President Obama's State of the Union speech last night? Did the fact-checking reporters get it right? Do these presidential addresses matter anymore? And how can we really measure which parts of the speech drew the most reaction from viewers? The president is being sandwiched in between two Republican candidate debates this week, and debates seem to be making a difference with the GOP electorate this time around. At least one candidate was put out with NBC's decision on Monday to stifle audience reaction. The Pew Center's weekly survey of news coverage versus news interest shows an interesting divergence between the preferences of oldsters and young news consumers. It started with an erroneous post by a student website, but why did traditional news outlets run with the premature news that former Penn State football coach Joe Paterno had died? And some of the big advertisers on the upcoming Super Bowl broadcast are previewing their commercials in advance with a not-so-surprising focus on humor and sex. Let's start with the annual ritual known as the State of the Union Address. President Obama gave his third last night. It was geared toward launching his reelection campaign and focused largely on his view of economic policies that are fair to all. One of the most quoted soundbites of the evening involved the president's proposal to change tax policy regarding offshore investments.
First, if you're a business that wants to outsource jobs, you shouldn't get a tax deduction for doing it. That money should be used to cover moving expenses for companies like Masterlock that decide to bring jobs home. Second, no American company should be able to avoid paying its fair share of taxes by moving jobs and profits overseas. From now on, every multinational company should have to pay a basic minimum tax, and every penny should go towards lowering taxes for companies that choose to stay here and hire here in America.
And again, most of the president's speech was just about like that. There was some talk of international issues. In fact, he framed the whole thing by starting with Osama bin Laden and ending basically with foreign policy in Afghanistan and Iraq. But most of it was about domestic, economic, and political issues. Every time we see a major address like this, Charles, the first question we ask is, how did the media frame it? What did they pull out of this, you know, hour plus, you know, speech that they thought was most newsworthy? What did you pick up from that?
Well, they spent a lot of time talking about a really bad joke about spilled milk. But they also, I think, talked about fairness, equity in the tax structure. I don't know if there's been a State of the Union address as dedicated to tax policy as this one was. I mean, he spent a long time on a treatment of tax and income inequality. I thought the point that he made about that being the defining issue of our time might have been a little overwrought. But it's certainly the defining issue of the coming presidential campaign. So as a pre-reelection campaign speech, I thought it was exactly what the news media would do with it, which is treat it in election narrative. So as opposed to treating it as a presidential speech, they treated it as a campaign speech.
And what was your thought on that, Linda, from watching some of the coverage?
Well, I think that some of the coverage I thought had it dead on, which just said, you know, in a lame duck year, well, in a year where you don't have control of Congress, what are you going to say that is legitimately, you know, there were some criticisms that he didn't have very specifics in his policies. Well, you don't want to put a lot of promises that you can't deliver on in your State of the Union address. And so I thought that framing also was pretty good, which it just said, you know, given where it comes, there wasn't a whole lot that he could do there. That being said, I think it is so small in comparison to the ongoing narrative that we have with all of the debates that are going on the Republican side, that it was a really small amount of campaign rhetoric in the midst of a very Republican-dominated time of year.
I'm curious to hear both of your thoughts about the fact-checking that went on. Some news organizations have been doing this with the debates and campaign commercials. Now they've did it with the president's speech. And, for example, I think they tended to come to a basic consensus that these speeches are so closely vetted that you don't get outright lies. That very seldom happens. But they did point out, as they do with Democrats and Republicans, that the president tried to fudge a few things. For example, the Washington Post fact checker, Charles, talked about the claim that the Taliban's momentum had been broken and that there was really no evidence that that was true. When we talk about foreign policy, another comment the president made about all his focus on outsourcing when really outsourcing has very little to do with our economic crisis in general, talking about how the president wanted it both ways on bailouts, whereas he was really proud of the bailout of General Motors in the automobile industry, but promised there would never be any bailouts of banks again. Serve a useful function, or do people just sort of automatically filter that through their own political persuasions?
I think it does serve somewhat of a useful function. I think sometimes it overextends itself too much when they start getting into nuance. I mean, there's fact and there's nuance, right? Whether or not they've broken the momentum of the Taliban is not a fact. It's an assertion. And of course, two different people could look at the evidence and come away with two very different meanings for broke the momentum of. It also may be in the president's defense, I think, he may know more from the intelligence briefings than the fact checkers can possibly get access to verify whether or not that's a factual statement, right? I mean, he's got access to a whole lot more intel around whether or not the Taliban's momentum has been broken than some dude doing a LexisNexis search in the Washington Post newsroom.
I did think, and of course, you're right about that, Charles, but there was one fact check item that I thought both spoke directly to what the president didn't talk about and what he did say when he was framing health care, because we all know he passed the, you know, Obamacare, quote unquote, one of his primary achievements in his first year or so in office. He really didn't talk about it very much last night, Linda. And when he did, he said, that's why our health care law relies on reformed private markets, not a government program. Well, half of the folks who are going to benefit from health care coverage under Obamacare, if it is finally rolled out, are going to be on Medicaid. That's a government program.
Well, absolutely. And the other thing about that is it's just, you know, again, it's kind of this framing. I want to point out the things that I – and in the way that make me look good, I want to ignore the things that I know have been touch points. You asked Charles, do people just put their own filter on? I think the ordinary citizens put their own filter on this. They've already decided, you know, I'm for him or I'm against him in that sense for Obama. And you're not going to see a lot of people paying attention to these kinds of fact-checking when it comes to that. But I do think that this kind of fact-checking is really that necessary part of journalism that if real journalists don't continue to do this kind of fact-checking, then what is journalism doing at all that with regard to our political process?
And I think a super important part of that is what fact-checking accomplishes. And what it does is hopefully keep them honest or at least let them think someone's going to check this. So before it comes out of my mouth, I'd better have some veracity behind it. I mean, 30 minutes after the speech, Mitt Romney said – absolutely falsely that Barack Obama's president has raised capital gains taxes. That is an empirical untruth. Right. That is a flat out lie. And so when you don't let politicians particularly get away with repeated lying, I think whether or not it scores any points for us is secondary to what it does to the democracy. It improves the debate.
Well, every year for the past few years, journalists, pundits, analysts have raised the question,
do we really need the State of the Union speech? Does it even right. matter anymore? Now, of course, it's an historical precedent. Presidents are going to give up on it. 20-some million Americans did watch some part of it last night on the networks. On the other hand, all of the president's speech was out there for anybody who wanted to know about it, basically hours in advance. We even had a new word being coined yesterday with the Republicans giving, quote, pre-buttle, as opposed to rebuttal, of the speech. I mean, we had Larry Sabato, one of the guys who follows presidential history and politics, saying, it's a big production that matters for a whole 24 hours or less, but we play along anyway. Howard Kurtz, you know, the media columnist for Newsweek and the Daily Beast basically said, you know, how long are we really going to remember this once the campaign heats up? Does this speech have any value in today's world?
I don't think this speech has particular value in today's world, but I think as a historic precedent, from my perspective in our society, I think the State of the Union to say, oh, well, we have lots of ways of getting that information. We're just not going to do it anymore. I think that in some way sets a precedent that I don't really have to be accountable to everybody at least once a year, kind of speaking on a wide range of issues. So I think it's an important ongoing tradition. I would hate to see it say, oh, you can just get that on Twitter or just listen to the daily press briefings. You don't need to know that.
Is the speech itself, in your opinion, Charles, still relevant, or is it just the coverage that follows or that comes before and follows after that speech?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a complete geek. I like to watch it. I sit down with the family and we watch it. I like these collective national experiences, you know, and there are two in the winter, the State of the Union and the Super Bowl, and I engage deeply in them both.
I was going to ask yeah, if you thought this was as popular.
I drink deeply with both of them, and because I think part of it is the sort of shared collective social experience, which there are a few events that many people can come in the next day and talk about, and I enjoy that. I also think it may not be as important as it used to be in terms of domestic politics, but I still think globally it is a very important moment because we do some serious symbolic communication to the rest of the world. And in that speech about Osama bin Laden, about the Taliban,
outsourcing of jobs.
Yeah.
I'm teasing.
He made overtures about China and fair trade. I mean, there were a lot of things that were said to external audiences. Right.
Well, another tradition in the past several years has been the rebuttal or response from the party that is not in the White House. And last time around, that speech, the post-debate speech or post-speech speech, I guess, really led to the downfall of somebody people thought might be a Republican star, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, the governor there. Well, last night, they actually had a governor that people had talked about running who pulled himself out, Mitch Daniels, and folks were falling over themselves on the right, at least, saying what a great speech it was. But Mara Liasson of NPR sort of brought up the idea that, well, maybe there's already – this is a more of a symbol of buyer's remorse. Isn't it too bad that he's not there, Republicans wishing they had Daniels still in the race?
He's sort of like that boyfriend who, you know, you broke up with in the eighth grade and then you see him in high school and you're just remorseful. I don't know. I watched the speech and I thought it was a well-executed speech, but it was interesting because Bobby Jindal, the last one, was so famously bad. And part of why it was so bad was he was wandering through the governor's mansion
right.
and then sort of looking off camera in a Michelle Bachman-esque sort of way. Boy, and Mitch Daniels, they'd have him taped to a chair. I mean, he could move no part of his lower body beneath his neck. And it came off as a bit stilted because of that. But, yeah, I think it's part of that. I also was struck by the fact that, what is this, three responses in a row in which no member of the congressional delegation of the Republican Party has offered right. the response, which says something about the congressional approval ratings, I think, of the Republican Party.
It certainly does. One of the things we have seen news organizations attempt to do in the past is measure the popularity of the speech, the president's speech. There was an interesting new way of measuring that this year, and that was through Twitter. And one of the things they did was measured the number of tweets minute by minute throughout the president's speech and then tried to figure out which topics were the most, at least, interesting, not necessarily popular. Well, the number one thing tweeted out of the debate was that pretty lame spilled milk joke that the president told. But after that, you had college tuition, Steve Jobs and the focus on innovation, energy policy, and then
when the president walked out and finally wrapped it up. So what do you take, if anything, from that, Linda?
Nothing. You take absolutely nothing from – no, you, here's what you take from that. And this is – I occasionally, during big events, Super Bowl type of activities, will get on Twitter. I wasn't on it last night. But what you find is even in a place where you think people aren't afraid to say anything on Twitter, they actually are, and they actually will only comment on things often – this isn't true of everybody, but they will frequently comment on things that are easy to skim off the top. And so commenting on somebody walking into a room, what color tie they're wearing, I've done it before myself, embarrassingly, and lame jokes is a lot easier. And college tuition, well, what kind of population is on Twitter? It's a kind of population that might very well be interested in college tuition. Not everybody, but a large percentage.
I did think it was interesting, though, Charles, that even though he didn't spend that much time talking about college education and spending and that much time on energy, those were the things that really jumped up with the younger Twitter.
Yeah, audience. It is interesting because they were minor parts of the speech. Yeah. He also, I think beneath that just one rung was high school. And he had this line in there about making sure to require everyone to graduate from high school or at least attend high school till they're 18, I think was the rule. I had a friend who tweeted almost instantly, 8,000 high school football coaches across the country are on board with that proposal. You know, there was probably a lot under education because of the demographics that it was reaching.
Well, as we said, the president's speech is being sandwiched by two Republican debates in Florida. One happened on Monday. And one is happening Thursday, tomorrow night, as we lead up to the Florida primary. And it's kind of interesting because NBC's Brian Williams, in hosting the debate, moderating the debate on Monday night, did something different from all the previous Republican debates that I've watched, at least so far. And that's that he admonished the audience, essentially, to do nothing. You can't applaud. You can't jeer. You can't really react in any way. And some people seem to believe, Linda, that that actually tamped down the interest and tamped down the candidates' abilities to really get their best lines out on TV.
I think it probably did. And I think any of us who've ever done any kind of public – so Charles and Mike and myself have lectured in front of classes. And every once in a while, you just get an audience that just won't respond to anything. They don't react. They don't look at you in a way that indicates that they're approving or disapproving. And that does kind of suck the energy out of your quote-unquote performance. So I can imagine somebody like Newt Gingrich, who is the one who complained mightily about Brian Williams' admonition, would find that a little bit not to his liking. I also reject the idea entirely that the purpose of the debate isn't to get a cheering audience behind you. And you know, I'm so disgusted by that whole idea.
I
don't know where to go
with
it.
This is a crowd, the GOP debate crowd. I mean, this is a crowd that in this season has booed the golden rule, cheered the execution of a man. So, I mean, to say it's a rowdy crowd that likes red meat thrown at it is not much of an understatement. And I think if the goal of your debating is to try and get the crowd cheering behind you, maybe you're missing the point. And so I can empathize with that. I think Newt's comeback, again, was brilliant, which is, don't I have a right to – I mean, nobody's saying you can't speak. They're saying that we're going to limit the crowd reaction in ways that will – honor the solemnity of the debate.
But you do look like you're coming off way too hot if there's no audience reaction when you start to getting, you know, your ire up in a debate. And for good or for ill, Linda, I notice that CNN is saying about their debate tomorrow that they are not restricting the audience's comments. They got the lesson.
Right.
They know what drives the ratings. They know what the audience wants.
Right. But the whole thing is rather comical because if you're doing – it's comical that we're parsing these rules in such a fine way when we have, you know, there are how many debates now? Are we into the dozens and, you know, scores of debates that we would get upset about the rules for this debate or that debate? And so it is kind of a big show and it's kind of disgusting.
I would have to say my counter to that is that I'd much rather have, if in fact it's happening, these debates, no matter how well formed they are, that they are, if they're having a bigger impact than campaign commercials, good for them. I'd like at least some semblance of discussion of the issues between the candidates to actually make a difference.
I wonder if the Republican Party, like when this is all said and done, might have a big confab where they go, okay, let's rethink a couple of things. One, that more debates are always good, and two, that this whole Citizens United Super PAC world is going to be just peachy keen for us, because the irony of both is sort of striking.
Well, with the presidential election going on, I thought it was just interesting to talk for a second about the weekly survey that the Pew mm-hmm. Research Center for the People and the Press puts out. It's their sort of weekly interest in the news index, and they ask people to tell the pollsters what story they paid the most attention to in the past week, and then they compare that to the amount of coverage the media actually gave to it. And this week we found some things from the general audience that wouldn't surprise anybody, I suppose. The cruise ship accident was the most attended to story by the audience overall last week, and then the 2012 elections came in second. Of course, the media covered them in just exactly the reverse order. But Linda, when you broke it down by age, they came up with something I found really fascinating. Now, maybe not surprising, but fascinating to me, and that's that the number one story last week for young people 18 to 29, the story they followed more closely than anything else, was the anti-piracy debate, with the websites blacking themselves out to protest SOPA and the other bills in Congress.
I think that speaks very much to the fact of it's a little bit like the Twitter response that we got to the State of the Union address, that this speaks to the fact that we have a lot of people who are going online. They use the computers, they're wired, they're connected, and they're using them every single day. And when you have something as popular as Google blacked out, their curiosity is sparked, and they say, oh, I want to know a little bit more about that. And I think that speaks it tells us a little bit about something about reaching larger populations of people in non-traditional audiences. They're not getting their news from the nightly news.
Another topic that came up over the weekend that just didn't surprise me. One more example, but the story started out with an error by some college students running a news service at Penn State. They heard that there was an email sent around to the football players that Joe Paterno had died. He had not died yet. He did die the next day. Okay, the college students made a mistake. The editor took the bullet, said, I'm going to resign over this. What I worry about, Charles, is why CBS News, the Huffington Post, and others ran that story, one, without checking it, and two, without attribution.
That's way more troubling. And ultimately, it was up to the Associated Press to knock the story down. They did some really good reporting and some really good use of Twitter to knock down that story. I mean, I saw a tweet early from the Associated Press Sunday evening. This all was happening around 9 o'clock.
Saturday, right.
I'm sorry. And I remember seeing a tweet from the Associated Press, because I follow them, because, again, with the whole geek thing. I got a thing from them saying, he is definitely not dead. And it was sent to all news agencies. So they were not only knocking it down within the walls of the AP, but they decided to go into the Twitterverse and knock it down, which I thought was – I don't know if I've seen that before, and I was really struck by, that's some good, what would you call that, unreporting? It's anti-reporting? I don't know.
Well, and it also speaks to AP's brand, that AP is still a trusted brand, and we have some respect. As news organizations, we have respect for AP as being reputable and going through a more thorough verification process than Huffington Post.
I guess I just wished that this incident and previous incidents would somehow lead to some changes in behaviors in our news organizations. Unfortunately, I'm kind of cynical, and I asked our students about this week. They said, they didn't think it was going to, one, damage the reputations of the news organizations in the long run, or that they were really going to do anything different as a result.
The AP has one rule in there. They have a five-part flowchart now. One of their rules I wish everyone would adopt. Have you talked to an actual human being about this, which
right.
I think is a great journalistic question.
Well, and one other little point about that. Many of the places where these decisions are being made, we have very young people who have grown up with sort of a different set of values. And that's not denigrating them, but that until you've been burned, you don't have that respect for verification.
That's true, but I also think maybe they were just reflecting their own sense of reality about, you know, anything goes on the internet and nothing seems to damage the reputations of people who violate journalistic norms these days. Well, let's end up with the fact that a week from Sunday, we're probably going to set another record for television viewing in America with NBC's coverage of the Super Bowl. Lots of viewers means, of course, lots of companies vying to reach them with advertising. They're going to be paying this year upwards of $3.5 million for a 30-second spot. And some of the most innovative sponsors aren't waiting until February 5th to get the message out. For example, Volkswagen, which had last year's hit commercial, which was an homage to Star Wars, has already seeded the web with a preview of this year's version. It's called The Bark Side. Meanwhile, GoDaddy.com, of course, is once again vying for the most controversial commercial. The web hosting company has race car driver Danica Patrick back. She and fitness guru Jillian Michaels are painting GoDaddy logos and slogans on a naked supermodel. Michaels insists the spot does not exploit women.
GoDaddy is definitely known for its sexy commercials. But for me, I really like it because it allows women to be strong and powerful, but still feminine and sexy. Everything we're doing because we want to be doing it. There's nothing that's exploiting us. It's a fun spot. It's a sexy spot. But we're fully clothed the entire time. And it's just, it's nice. It's like, it's irreverent. And I like that.
Okay, Linda, you get the first word
on
this one.
Oh, yeah. Let's let the out-of-shape woman talk about Jillian Michaels on the,
naked supermodels.
Right. Anything that I could say will just sound jealous and petty. These are the same kinds of arguments about exploiting women that we've seen, you know, for decades. And so it's not surprising to me that GoDaddy would be doing this kind of commercial. It's not surprising to me that somebody who is ultra fit and makes all of her money on basically her body would say that it doesn't exploit women. I know a few women who would beg to differ.
And men. Now, of course, GoDaddy, their founders would argue, you know, this stuff works. We wouldn't do it if it didn't work. And they pointed out the first time they did one of these racy commercials on the Super Bowl, their recognition in the world went up by many percentage points. I don't know if it still works today. There are some experts that say sex really doesn't sell that much as maybe humor or other approaches.
Yeah, it's the old drug dealer argument. They want it, right? They want it, so I provide it. It's a very ethically difficult position to take. And the response by Jillian, I think, was exactly what you would expect, which is, I don't feel exploited. Well, no, it's not about you. It's about many other women who, I think, as you rightly pointed out, feel very differently about the subject.
I will say this. GoDaddy basically said, this is what we've been doing all along. We had a very complicated product, and the only thing that we could really do in a 30-second commercial is get our name out there, and by, you know, putting a busty woman in a tight T-shirt with our logo on it, we did just that. When we first introduced ourselves. And they were right about that. So in that sense, yes, sex did sell for them.
They could have had barking dogs. It would have worked just as well.
We're not going to have time to talk much about it today. In fact, not at all. But look at our website to read some of the comments about how these advertisers are now using social media as a way to reach a whole new audience, to reinforce the message, to generate more sales. And you wonder if more and more of the ad budgets aren't going to move in that direction. Well, we're going to have to stop the discussion right there this week. Thanks to Linda and Charles for their comments. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Raymond Tungekar for producing our program. And thanks to you for listening and watching. You can visit KBIA.org and click on Talk Shows, then Views of the News if you want to watch videos, read stories related to our topics, or even leave a comment. We also encourage you to email us at views@KBIA.org. I'm Mike McKean. Join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.